Traditionally in the summer, Northern Soundings takes a break. This year is a little different. I'm delighted to reintroduce a new generation to a wonderful series KUAC broadcast some 30 years ago. Sunday at Noon and later Conversations featured Susan McGinnis talking with some historically significant and thoughtful people at the time about Alaska. Susan has selected discussions for this summer series. This show, Susan talks with Fairbanks author Dan O'Neill about his book, The Firecracker Boys, which examines Project Chariot, a plan to detonate hydrogen bombs near Cape Thompson in Alaska. Dan O'Neill has authored several other nonfiction works about Alaska, including The Last Giant of Beringia and A Land Gone Lonesome. Here's Susan's conversation from the 1990s with author Dan O'Neill.
I want to start with the man whose brainchild Project Chariot was, with Edward Teller. Born in 1908, Hungarian, brilliant, educated in Leipzig in thermonuclear physics, and left Germany when he felt anti-Semitism would keep him from doing his work. That's 20 seconds worth of Edward Teller. Can you introduce us to him in a meaningful way relative to Project Chariot?
Well, he certainly did grow up amid political turmoil, and perhaps that may have colored his philosophy and led him into the inner circles of weapons development throughout the history of nuclear weapons. He's always been at the center. I was pretty impressed reading about his biography before I interviewed him, and he's clearly a creative genius. But he's also probably the ultimate cold warrior, the biggest anti-communist of them all. And so he was a very dedicated scientist in terms of weapon development, and pushed very hard for the development of the H-bomb after the war was over. And it seems he's a hard guy to figure, because on the one hand you understand this tremendous interest in science, this near-religious experience with science, but on the other hand he's a master salesman, and some would say a propagandist, and I think that's not too unfair. But he has been very masterful at getting his political agenda adopted, you know, over the last 40 years through many administrations.
You wrote, I was intrigued by this phrase, that for Teller, science was his refuge and his weapon. The weapon was against communism, which I take to be because of his youth in Hungary and this awful, unstable situation there. Why refuge? Why'd you put that word on him?
He seemed to do best when he was deep into esoteric science. It was, I speculate, a source of stability, emotional stability for him after living through a couple repressive regimes in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Here's one other spike, is the only way I can characterize it, from your description of Teller. After Trinity was exploded, this massive thermonuclear experiment in Nevada, several scientists responded by saying they were humbled, they were overwhelmed. One man quoted the Bhagavad Gita and said, "I am death." He'd been a scientist working on the project. Where the description of Teller was that he said something about, "I put on sunblock, suntan lotion, and sunglasses, and went out and watched it, and I was impressed." Mm-hmm. And I thought, my God, what a difference between these two characterizations.
Yeah, he said, "I looked the beast in the eye, and I was impressed." And it's a pretty apt little description that sets Teller apart from many of his colleagues, I think. I guess when I went to interview him, I went in thinking, as I was saying, that here's a guy who values and reveres science and the process of acquiring knowledge at such a high level that this was going to be a wonderful experience just to see someone like that deal with intellectual exchange. But I was completely bowled over by what it seemed to me was a lack of appreciation for knowledge and how we get to know what we know and holding truth so reverentially. And I came away feeling that he really is a propagandist. I mean, in the ordinary rules of discourse, you know, that when you speak, I listen. And if you have said something different than what I believed and it makes sense, then I'm willing to change. Those simple, ordinary rules of discourse didn't apply in his case. And if you asked a question that he thought would thwart his purposes, he took it deeply personally, and he reacted very angrily. And so he was fundamentally an anti-intellectual.
Intellectual.
Yeah, exactly. And I was not prepared for that at all.
William Teller. We're talking with Dan O'Neill. His book is The Firecracker Boys, published by St. Martin's Press in 1994. We'll find out in a minute who named this book, The Firecracker Boys. The Firecracker Boys was the name given to Edward Teller and the rest of the scientists at Lawrence Radiation Laboratory who proposed Project Chariot. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. The time at which Project Chariot was introduced was a time of conflict. Some people saw the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki as a great triumph for democracy, a great triumph that forced the end of a dreadful war. Others saw it as human and planetary mutilation. Then the Cold War came in to these mixed feelings and moved them farther. What I think I'm trying to approach is that there was a great agitation for test ban at the point at which Project Chariot began to be conceived. Can you, with this kind of awkward beginning, carry us forward to Chariot?
Yeah, particularly after the 1954 Bravo shot in the Pacific, a thermonuclear detonation which went at least double what was expected, 15 megaton, enormous explosion, and some Japanese fishermen were irradiated. They were well outside of the exclusion zone, but some of them died as a result. This was picked up by the popular press, and it was in everyone's mind then about the dangers of fallout, and that started building then through the 50s. And I think the reason why the Livermore scientists came up with this idea of using the nuclear weapon as a peacetime tool was in large part to cultivate an atmosphere of public opinion receptive to testing, weapons testing. So all the rhetoric that surrounded these proposals had to do with wonderful engineering works and economic development and progress of man. But internal documents show that the real interest was to recast the weapon as a benign tool so that the public would be more receptive to the continuance of atmospheric weapons testing. So that seems to be... Now, there certainly were true believers among the proponents of this plowshare program, of which Chariot was to be the first detonation. People who thought mining could be facilitated and excavation of mountain passes and harbors could be done usefully and productively. But it seems that the highest echelons, the goal was a public relations one primarily.
Tell me about this urge to keep building bigger and better nuclear weapons. Was this absolutely and solely because of the Cold War battle against the Soviet Union?
Well, I don't know. I definitely think that the people who worked on the development of nuclear weapons today believe that they did stave off World War III, and that this philosophy of deterrence worked, and maybe it did. Mm-hmm. But as to what their personalities were like and how scientists can be turned towards this kind of purpose, this sort of destructive purpose, it, it seems to fit that people who, well, I don't know, the Alaskans always considered that these guys were like little boys playing with their firecrackers.
That's where this came
and
from.
And so they took to calling the nuclear physicists the firecracker boys. And I just have to say I've seen that element in these guys, that if it was possible to do it, they wanted to do it. And there wasn't a whole lot of thought given to possible consequences.
So it might have been weapons, or it might have just been, let's see what we can do next. Edward Teller said something about it won't be possible to resist shooting at the moon. And he meant shooting a nuclear bomb off in the direction of the moon, right, to see what would happen?
Right. And that's a hard one because, you know, a lot of brilliantly creative ideas are borderline with madness. And that's why we need review of scientific proposals by non-scientific people, you know, ordinary people, people who worry about different things. But Teller proposed things like shooting a nuclear bomb at the moon in order to learn a little bit about the moon's properties. He proposed to nuking the Rock of Gibraltar and closing the strait to allow the Mediterranean to rise and freshen from river runoff, and then to use that fresh water to irrigate the Sahara. You know, at what point he started to think about what would happen to Venice, I don't know. But other proposals were like to melt the polar ice cap and change weather, very big wholesale intrusions into the natural environment. And a lot of these guys got caught up in the hubris and the momentum of the newfound scientific power and technological powers that they became the social experts, too. People deferred to them in the social question of, should we do it? And that was, so this was an important time in the history of science, science and public policy, where people started to realize that the experts are there for consulting, but the decisions ought to be left to the democratic process. And I think that was really crucial. And Barry Commoner was the guy who I think best formulated that at the time.
We'll talk more about Barry Commoner as we move along. One of the rationales for Plowshare, and of course Project Plowshare is about the biblical admonition to beat your weapons into plowshares. One of the functions of Plowshare was to repair the planetary errors, to make right the things that God had not done well enough. So there was a godly aspect to all of this.
Yeah, but when scientists set themselves up as gods, I think it's time for people to worry. And this is a case study of where an arguably crazy proposal went pretty far down the track and was only derailed by a very humble, modest, ragtag little group of ordinary people.
Okay. Why Project Chariot and why Alaska? Why do we want to bomb a harbor out of Point Hope?
Well, they claimed there's two answers. One is the official version, and one is what you can figure out from the research. And the official version was that they would like to develop this technology and test it so that they could export it principally to Panama. They were interested in excavating a new Panama Canal at sea level, which would have taken hundreds of thermonuclear bombs to do. So they felt that before they could take this abroad, they needed to have a successful test on their own soil. And so you needed a place remote because it was a test. You didn't know what was going to happen. And Alaska looked good. It had a lot of coastline, so we could judge the effects of the crater formation and slope stability in a water environment. And also because it was sparsely populated and out of the way. Now, maybe that's the official line. And they said, they came north and said, this is an economic development proposal. There's high-grade coal very near this area, just waiting to be exported if only we had a harbor. And same with fishing stocks. They said commercial fishing was impeded for a lack of a safe haven. Well, neither thing was true. There simply were no fish stocks marketable in that region. And the coal they were talking about was on the other side of the Brooks Range, hundreds of miles away, would have required a railroad and the construction of storage warehouses for this coal, then to be exported during that short, maybe 3-month shipping season. So
this is something about Teller and his crew and their ignorance of the Alaskan environment, both in terms of climate and geography, yes?
Yeah, it does. They did commission a study, a paper study done by an outfit in Minnesota, and they did not travel to Alaska. And they thought this thing was possible based on that. But it seems like they didn't have really any knowledge at all of Alaska conditions and people and economy and so forth. Mm-hmm. And that in the course of this project, they got an education.
Indeed. This is Dan O'Neill with us. His book, again, is The Firecracker Boys. Dan has been a researcher with the Oral History Project at the University of Alaska Fairbanks since 1984. His job is to conceive of projects, find funding for them, and carry them out, all projects that have to do with the oral and other history of Alaska. He's worked on projects that have to do with science and transportation. And this project, which did not begin as a book project, which began about 7 years prior to the 1994 publication, as I said, is called The Firecracker Boys. When Edward Teller and his entourage arrived in Juneau, they arrived unannounced and kind of flattered the white people a lot. You know, you're smarter than the average bear, and you are forward-thinking, and we know that you think science is important, and you will embrace this project. And some did, and some didn't. There was some kind of standing back and saying, well, what do you want to put a harbor way up there for, right?
Yeah. He really did butter up the Alaskans and called them big people and said big projects need big people, and big people are found in big states. He really played on Alaskan self-image as pioneering frontiers people, intrepid, ready to take on a new, possibly risky venture, that this played right into the hands of the frontiersmen. And I think he sold that very effectively. In the beginning, to their great credit, some of the Alaska businessmen said, well, an instant harbor sounds great, but why way up there?
Yeah.
I mean, it was 300 miles north of Nome. And so they proposed other canals blasted through the Alaska Peninsula or damming the Yukon or the Copper, lots of big mega projects. They were happy to embrace the technology but wanted it to be something that would be very useful. It was a classic sales campaign, and in short order, pretty much every what the AEC called opinion shaper in the state signed on. Mm-hmm. The Chambers of Commerce endorsed it in a big way. The editors of the papers editorialized in their classic overstated way in favor of this. On down the line, the legislature passed a resolution, the administration of the university. Everybody said, let's do it. This will put Alaska on the map, make jobs for people, bring federal dollars to the state, all the same arguments we hear ever since then, all the way through our history.
This is a rebroadcast from the 1990s of Susan McGuinness's show, Conversations. She's talking this episode with author Dan O'Neill about his book on Project Chariot. The conversation continues after this short break.
When, not this same crew, but another pair of scientists from Lawrence Radiation Laboratory came to the University of Alaska Fairbanks, they were confronted by a group of young biology professors, essentially, yes?
That's right, yeah. Biologists were really coming into their own in that period, and we were starting to have people trained in ecology on the campuses, and they had read about the fallout issues and monitored this somewhat. And Linus Pauling and Edward Teller were continuously debating the hazards of fallout. And so when the Livermore guys came up here to sell the project, some of the biologists on campus stood up and said, well, now you're saying that this will be a useful scientific experiment, But no useful science can be done without an adequate baseline study. You won't know what you did if you don't know what was there before. So what they were doing was agitating for baseline environmental studies in that region prior to the shot. And the Atomic Energy Commission said, great, we'll fund those studies. And many people believe that by doing so, they felt they were buying off their chief and most articulate and informed critics.
This was effectively, and this is, I think, important to say, this was effectively the first steps towards the very first environmental impact statement.
Yeah,
right?
I think it was the first de facto environmental impact statement. It wasn't called by that name. That term hadn't been invented yet. But it was a multidisciplinary study of the land, sea, of the people, and the atmosphere of a single region prior to the conducting of a project. And it was done for planning purposes, at least ostensibly. And so that, I think, meets the definition of what an environmental impact statement is. And it was full 10 years before the National Environmental Policy Act mandated those documents. So it was really it was an amazing thing these guys agitated for and put together. And also, I should say that one of the people who pushed this proposal through mm-hmm. was a guy from the Atomic Energy Commission, a scientist named John Wolf. And I think he was a very visionary man, and I think he was very heroic in the way he took on his agency, which had very little use for spending millions of bucks just to appease a handful of biologists and environmentalists, then called conservationists. But he pushed it through, and he organized these studies. Later on, I think he dissembled rather badly mm-hmm. when characterizing these studies to the press. But you have to really give him credit, because the documents he wrote arguing for these studies, I think, are like the earliest manifestos of the need for this type of assessment.
He said a wonderful thing, and I can only paraphrase it, but it was something about, as we move into the atomic age, it is not too early to look closely at the environment we'll be impacting. In 1957 or 58, this was a pretty astounding statement, yes?
That's right.
We should stop and take a look at lichen.
He was a brilliant guy. He was super articulate. He was very forceful of personality. And he took on Edward Teller and the others and insisted this be done.
Okay. There are at this point two or three tracks moving along, and one of them is Edward Teller, the AEC, Atomic Energy Commission, and the Lawrence Radiation Laboratory's intention to do something called Project Chariot. The second, then, is this child of the environmental impact study that is beginning to go on at the university. There are two more tracks, and one of them is the response at Point Hope. It took a while for the folks from Lawrence Radiation and AEC to get there, but they did get there. Mm-hmm. They didn't have the response they expected, which I think is the most interesting beginning to this next phase of our discussion. Can you describe what they thought they were going to see when they got there and what confronted them?
Well, I don't know what was in their mind for sure, but they had a pretty good track record to date of getting what they wanted done. And they were very sophisticated people in terms of public presentations. They brought films and polished speakers and experts. And so it was close to 2 years, 3 years before they went up to Point Hope to tell the people what was planned to happen right in their backyard, 30 miles away. And the every other village they had gone to on the northwest coast of Alaska had offered no opposition, no significant questions of any kind on the project. But at Point Hope, those people were set up with two tape recorders on the head table when the guys walked in, and they tape recorded the entire meeting. And it was a brilliant move, and it was sure lucky for me they did too.
Oh, of course. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah.
Researcher.
It's a really interesting story, because I found in the archives a partial transcript of that meeting, and it done by one of the fellows in the village who was a white guy from outside, who was a critic of Project Chariot. So you kind of have to take with some circumspection his edits in transcribing this tape. And so I was looking for the original tape for years and years, everywhere I could think of. Mm-hmm. And finally, I saw in a letter that somebody had sent the tape to a woman in Massachusetts. And it turned out, I took a stab, and she lived at the same address as she had 30 years ago. She was 90 years old, and she had the tape. And so she mailed it up to me, and we had quite a long correspondence, and she's a really lovely lady.
Well, now tell me, why was it sent to someone in Massachusetts?
Well, yeah, good question. As the opposition to Chariot grew, there were a lot of different entities outside who started to agitate on behalf of the Eskimo people. And this was through the Episcopal Church, and the minister at Point Hope and the one in Massachusetts had switched pulpits for a summer. And so Keith Lawton from Point Hope had gone down there and appeared on TV shows and gave interviews to the newspapers and spoke from the pulpit about Chariot and the people's opposition to it. And so there grew up back east a little anti-Chariot movement in parallel with the one here.
It's interesting that movements are almost person by person rather than something larger. They seem to move from person to person to person.
Yeah, it was classic grassroots activism, I think.
Indeed. On this edition of Conversations, we're taking a look at something that never happened. Project Chariot, conceived in 1957, 58, roughly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Died in 1962, a shelf death. It was shelved and not pulled out again. In the process, however, of moving from its birth date to its shelf date, Project Chariot created changes in the scientific community. It may be responsible for transforming a conservation movement to an environmentalist movement, and may also be somewhat responsible for creating a platform in the second half of the 20th century for Native Alaskan activism. Project Chariot, our subject on this edition of Conversations. Our guest is Dan O'Neill. Dan was born in San Francisco in 1950. He's been in Alaska since 1975, educated both in California and at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He's been a research associate with the Oral History Project at the Elmer Rasmussen Library at the University of Alaska Fairbanks since 1984. Firecracker Boys, the book that came out of Project Chariot, is only one of several oral and other history projects that Dan O'Neill has been working on. Project Chariot on this edition of Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is KUAC. The Inupiaq people, when the scientists came to talk to them, talked back and asked questions. What were some of the questions I gather were most unexpected?
Well, what the Eskimo people caught on right away to was the really core inconsistency. And that was that the scientists were giving them blanket reassurances that no harm would come to them.
Mm-hmm.
But when they said why they wanted to do it in the first place, they said it was because they wanted to see how this experiment would go, to see how much radiation would come out, what kind of excavation would take place. They wanted to test the technology. Well, you can't say both things at the same time. You can't say it's an experiment and yet you know the result will be safe. So they saw that and said, you know, if there's any possibility of risk to our animals and to our homeland here, we don't want to see it. Do it where you live. And there was just a lot of very poignant statements made at that meeting, and also much of what the AEC representatives were saying to the people there at that meeting in March 14, 1960, was simply untrue. And they must have known it to be untrue, because the publications of the day, both the AEC's own publications and those of critics or those of disinterested scientists, were all saying, for instance, that low levels of radiation can cause cancer, depending on dose, but certainly the high doses were, and genetic effects. And yet these people, these representatives of the AEC, were telling the Eskimo people that even at Hiroshima, people who received large doses of radiation, once they recovered from the initial injury, like skin lesions and nausea, suffered no further effects. Well, the documents published by that agency for years before that meeting said that it certainly did cause such things as leukemia and cataracts, at least. And then many people were saying cancers and shortening of life and birth defects and so forth.
Were there also evidences by now of long-term damage to the Polynesian population of the Marshall Islands?
They were beginning to show increased incidences of thyroid disease, particularly among the Marshallese. Mm-hmm. That's right. So a lot of the... I went back and found their old publications. You know, you could find how a single publication changed over time as it was revised. Mm-hmm. And it was a telling little history of the AEC's position on these specific issues. So you could show that agency policy before that meeting was that this type of exposure did cause problems, but the representatives at Point Hope told the people it didn't. So it was really something to get this tape recording, because it's irrefutable.
It seems to me that the first presentations in Juneau and Anchorage and Fairbanks did something to alter the project idea a little bit, and what was happening in Nevada at the same time, other experiments, other blasts, altered the notion of what Project Chariot might be, and that the presentation by folks from Lawrence Radiation at UAF and then UAF's response altered the vision of the project. When the presentation was made at Point Hope, do you sense any alteration of the project as a result of their response?
When you look at the agency documents, the only effect it seems to have had is that they wanted to be much more careful when it came to approaching the public again. Yeah. You know, it was almost a PR lesson that was learned. It was really interesting to see that Public Health Service people went up to Point Hope. Nominally, they were radiation safety officers looking at ways in which they could make sure no one was injured by the experiment. But when they wrote their reports, it had nothing to do with health and safety, but had everything to do with the public sentiment and how it could best be addressed. So it looks clear that Public Health Service personnel were co-opted into following the political agenda of the Atomic Energy Commission.
I want to just kind of probe the hearts of man at this point a little bit. Do you think that the people who were making these presentations, whether we're talking about public health people or scientists from Livermore or people from AEC, do you think they thought that their mission was so important that folks could be lied to, that the consequences to somebody living in Point Hope would be less important in the long run than what was created because of Chariot? Or something else?
I think that's quite likely, really, that those people felt like they had a pretty good handle on what was best for mankind, that whether it was economic development or whether it was the development of this new geographical engineering technique, that they were better equipped to assess the trade-offs. On the one hand, you had science and economic development. On the other, you had the health and safety of people. And that's really a crucial issue. It's a lot like Oliver North in the Iran-Contra affair. Mm-hmm. Oliver North felt he knew better than the public or the Congress about the threat from Central America, and he organized an expeditionary force outside of the democratic procedures. He thought he knew better than the people elected what was best for the country. But the fallacy of that is, in trying to save this country, he was diminishing what the country was. We were a system of laws, a method of democracy, and he subverted that in his effort to protect it.
And you feel that Project Chariot did the same thing to science?
I do. These guys thought, well, really, we're nuclear physicists, after all. We know a whole lot more about the big picture than to villagers in Point Hope. And so our job is really to convince them. It's not to lay out the cost-benefit analysis and see how they react. Mm-hmm. And I think you see that coming up over and over.
Interesting. Let's come back to Fairbanks. At the same point as all these things were happening in other communities and up on the Hill at the university, kind of this early environmental impact study was being done, there was a Fairbanks tradition going on, which is a war of letters to the editor in the newspaper. One of the writers was Ginny Wood, a bush pilot and lodge owner and kind of early conservationist, as that word was carefully defined. She wrote letters to the editor and, I gather, letters to other people saying essentially the same thing they said in Juneau first. What do you mean a harbor at Point Hope? And then she said, what do you mean the fallout will blow away? And it seems that this letter and letters like it was the thing that generated a move from the conservation movement to the environmental movement. If I've led us in the right direction, can you explain how that happened?
Well, there was a little group of conservationists here in Fairbanks, Celia Hunter and Ginny Wood and Bob and Judy Whedon and Fred and Sue Dean, and just really a handful.
Folks.
Yeah. And they, some of them, and Les Virick and Bill Pruitt were biologists on the faculty here. And so we were just starting to see how technological projects could deeply affect ecological systems. And here were the guys who knew about ecology. And they were outdoor people, and they cared about the country and the what are today called wilderness values and so forth. But they had the equipment and the energy and the intellect and the drive to really articulate this point of view very early on. You know, this was even before Rachel Carson's Silent Spring by 4 years. Mm-hmm. And so I think that once they entered into this fight where you were defending a piece of scenery that wasn't spectacular. I mean, what didn't have, you know, magnificent geological formations or raging rivers or whatever. And it wasn't some endangered species of animal that was needing protection, but it was a simple system, a quiet little place, and the possible danger to the threat was invisible. It wasn't, you know, a giant smokestack or a bulldozer. It was radiation that you couldn't even see. And so the argument then was grounded in ecology, in the science of the interrelationships of organisms. And so I think that was one of the very first battles fought in those terms, and certainly the first time that the Atomic Energy Commission was ever thwarted in carrying out one of its projects.
David and Goliath.
Yeah.
Perhaps this is to draw a more intricate picture of the David aspect of this David and Goliath situation. It seems that Lichen brought this project down in many ways. Am I right in saying that?
Well, the biologists all say that.
Well, let's look at it from a biological point of view. Why lichen? What is it about lichen that became an important hammer at the leg of Project Chariot?
This was really interesting. What they were noticing at this time, the scientists who were studying the effects of nuclear explosions, was that the fallout would go up into the stratosphere and settle down to Earth where it will, but predominantly in the temperate zones. So there was actually more fallout on the ground in the lower states than there was up here. Mm-hmm. But somehow the animals, the caribou, for instance, were showing up, and the people were showing up with more of these radionuclides in their body than were the animals and people at the lower latitudes.
The caribou and the people who ate the caribou.
Right, uh-huh. Yeah. And so they're trying to figure out this puzzle. Well, it had to do with the ecological cycle. In the lower states, the fallout would land on grass, for example, but the grass dies seasonally, so then it was gone and in the soil, and
it would get uptaken back into plants, but only discriminately. It would be discriminated against at the root wall, and there was more of the nutrients to draw from in the soil, so there was more competition, so less likelihood the radioactive elements went up into the blade and then was eaten by the animal. But up north, we didn't have grasslands, we had tundra. Mm-hmm. And the lichen in the tundra is this spongy, rootless plant that lived for decades and decades and was built to grab its nutrition from dust in the air. So it was a perfect mechanism to capture fallout. So you had acres and acres of the lichen soaking up fallout year after year and keeping it in its body, and then the caribou would graze over acres and acres of this stuff and concentrate all of that into their body.
Bones and tissue.
Yeah. And then the Eskimo people would pick it up when they ate them. So that showed that the ecological reality of our region was so different from the Atomic Energy Commission in the tropics or in Nevada that it really conditioned whether or not this thing should go forward.
And this, on a person-by-person level, this revolutionized one plant physiologist in St. Louis at Washington University, and that was Barry Commoner, who then changed his life from scientist to activist, yes?
Yeah, he was not trained as an ecologist, but a botanist of some stripe, I forget which. But when he figured this out, he said, when I interviewed him, it was a neat thing, he said, I suddenly discovered that what we were doing in our work opposing fallout was really just an aspect of this larger question of what might be called environmentalism. And so he, at that point, shifted his organization, which was called the Committee for Nuclear Information, into the Committee for Environmental Information. Mm-hmm. And their journal became the journal Environment, which is still published today. And he really led the way toward this emerging environmentalism. And by 1970, he was on the cover of Time as the leader of this brand new movement.
Right.
This is a rebroadcast from the 1990s of Susan McGuinness's show, Conversations. She's talking this episode with author Dan O'Neill about his book on Project Chariot. The conversation continues after this short break.
We're talking to Dan O'Neill about Project Chariot and what came of it. Project Chariot was short-lived, 1958 or so to 1962, and never happened. But what has come of it is a lot. I'm Susan McGuinness. This is Conversations. Dan O'Neill is with us. Let's go back to the University of Alaska Fairbanks. It kind of inadvertently, a major battle for academic freedom was being fought on this campus. And on this campus, some of the casualties of Project Chariot were created. Just to again to introduce us very briefly, the scientists, Les Ferrick and Bill Pruitt, Don Foote, who had been the kind of the human geographer, had been working out of Point Hope, had all been submitting their reports to the AEC through the university. And discovered that what the AEC was feeding back was not what they were reporting.
Yeah, it started pretty early on, before studies even began. Some of the Atomic Energy Commission people were saying, it looks from our studies that the spring is the best time of year to shoot off the bombs because the ground is covered with snow. In the spring it'll melt and all get flushed out to sea. And a number of other reasons. But at that point, no one had studied snow data there. No one had been there enough to take in the spring to take those measurements to know if that was so. And there were several other points in the first statement coming from the AEC which could not be substantiated by the scientific research, period. And so four of these scientists wrote to the Atomic Energy Commission and said, these are inaccurate or not supported by our data. And they didn't really get a satisfactory resolution. There was no retraction, no change. But they were working from within and going to do good science and see how it worked out. Eventually, what was happening is that the preliminary reports kept coming into the AEC, but they wouldn't release them. They would only release a summary of the reports. And the scientists felt that the summaries weren't accurate, that they very often were leaving out crucial details, which suggested, didn't prove, but suggested the project might be a risky one. And so on campus here, the scientists went to their department head and they went to the president and they complained that their data were being improperly used. And that to them was a very important thing. Well, they didn't get any support from the university president. He said, if they hired you to produce the data, it's their data. They can do with it as you like, as they like. Your options are to either go along or quit.
It's important to note that this isn't a wildcat perspective, and it is still an argument being fought between scientists and funders of scientific research today, yes?
Well, I don't know. I think it should be fairly well sorted out that a scientist owes his allegiance to his discipline, and even more than that, to a moral view of the world first, and that when funders take data and misuse it for improper purposes, that it is their responsibility to speak up. And these guys did. They took that to heart. They spoke up and they published through the Alaska Conservation Society's news bulletin what amounted to a minority report saying, here's what we found. And they tried to do it fairly dispassionately and citing the literature and carefully. But that was too much for a lot of people. They felt that this was improper to publish outside of the funding agency. Mm-hmm. And so this, I guess the suggestion was made by the president that the department might be better off without these people on the faculty. And then shortly thereafter, their contracts were not renewed. Now, different reasons in each case and lots of qualifications that are contained in the book, but it does seem that, in part at least, they lost their jobs because of their opposition to Project Chariot.
Mm-hmm. The information that they fought so hard to get out got out, though.
It did, yes, and Pruitt's learning of this lichen caribou man pathway, he didn't do experiments himself, but he saw this in the literature as he was doing his work, turned out to be a very crucial point, and had a lot to do with the cancellation of the project, no doubt. Mm. But like I say, that's the biologists see it that way, and you could talk to agency people, bureaucrat people in Washington who, at the Department of Interior, who agitated against this, and they like to think that their efforts were the key ingredient in the cancellation. And then there were the Native people at Point Hope who were generating quite a bit of publicity, and it just began to be a pretty high public relations cost to force this project down the Eskimos' throats. And so, and as you mentioned earlier, at the same time, too, as this project was being delayed, the AEC was continuing to do experiments in Nevada and learning information that the Chariot shot would have provided. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of reasons why it didn't happen.
Do you see that all, each and all of these activisms, whether we're looking at the Department of the Interior, the AEC, the Inupiaq people, or the environmentalists or the scientists, each of them evolved naturally out of the times when you were researching this, did you see, well, that makes sense, I see, that's what was happening then? Or do you think Project Chariot was a special spur? I guess that's what I'm asking.
Well, it does seem to be at the crossroads of a lot of historical trends. It seemed that was a big shifting over point in the terms of the environmental movement being born out of the conservation movement. And it does seem, too, that the Native peoples of Alaska coalesced politically largely in response to the Chariot controversy. The Tundra Times was founded as a direct result of this threat. and the people organized very effectively, the Eskimo people first, and then the Athabascans in the interior followed that model to organize the next year. And pretty soon they had a potent political force to carry to Congress with their land claims fight. And I think maybe in terms of science ethics and academic freedom, you know, this was part of many such Cold War episodes on campus. But that was starting to be a turning point where we realized that we'd let the government too deeply into the university. And things changed after that.
Dan O'Neill is with us on Conversations. Among other things that Dan has done, a number of publications. He's written for newspapers around the state, written for scholarly journals. He's got an article in the Dictionary of Literary Biography on Howard Rock, co-authored with Dr. Patrick Daly. Another on the coverage of Exxon Valdez, co-authored with Pat Daly in the Journal of Communication. He completed between 85 and 86 two series of radio productions called Recorded History, one focused on science, the other on transportation, both on Alaska. The transportation series of Recorded History received the 1986 Best of the West Award. West stands for Western Educational Society for Telecommunications. Dan O'Neill, our guest on this edition of Conversations. I want to take us away from Project Chariot just a bit. In 1992, there were hearings held here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks at which some pretty remarkable statements were made about Soviet nuclear waste and dumping. In an article about this conference you wrote, I think for the Anchorage Daily News, you said something about if you were to stand next to a lake by a plutonium factory in Siberia, I think, for an hour, you would essentially kill yourself.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, it was a phenomenal statement in a series of phenomenal statements about Soviet dumping. And I think we have maybe 8 or 9 minutes left. I'd like you just to take a look at what you think the state of the impact of this end of the arms race is in our future. What are we looking at? Huge question, I'm sorry. Answer a small chunk of it and we'll move on from there.
Well,
I was so impacted by that lake, though. I just had to raise it for you so you'd reflect back what you think about it.
Well, we have found out from our CIA and from Russian scientists, now that the Soviet Union collapsed, about the extent of the environmental contamination as a result of their nuclear programs. And they did have a Soviet version of our plowshare program, like our Project Chariots. They did detonate bombs to for civil works. And we're told that the environmental consequences were outrageous, just devastating destruction over there from radiation. And I think it's very interesting and telling to note that even into the 1990s, Edward Teller held up the Soviet example as a model we should have followed. And it was a good thing that we didn't let him, or we would have that same legacy here. But we are finding out little by little in this country what all has been the environmental cost of our Cold War militarization. And we hear about nerve gas rockets and biological weapons ordnance that have been buried here near our military bases. And, of course, there was
And by here, you don't mean United States.
Alaska.
You mean here.
Yeah,
here. Yeah. Tanoff Flat.
That's right.
Yeah.
And disposal of munitions off the Aleutians, a host of things like that. But it's difficult for us to get that information because of classification and secrecy, and some of the records seem to have been destroyed and so forth. But the other thing that came up just about that time as we were learning about the Soviet contamination was I released some documents that showed that there was a small quantity of radioactivity buried
at the Chariot site near Point Hope. And I should say a little about that, because it became just a worldwide story. It was in New York Times,
right.
Page One LA Times. People told me they heard it in Tokyo Times, just all over. But it was, I had found these documents that said the Atomic Energy Commission had buried this stuff up there.
It brought some fallout from Nevada,
yeah.
Right?
When Chariot was canceled, they instead shot off a bomb in Nevada to answer many of the same questions, almost a substitute for Chariot. They collected some of that dirt and hauled it up, about a shopping bag-sized bundle of dirt, and they sprinkled it on the tundra, hosed it down, and they collected the runoff to see to what extent that radioactivity would move with surface runoff or bind up with the soil and plants. And so that was a pretty good experiment. But what they shouldn't have done was bury the waste there, and particularly not without asking the people's permission or even telling them that they had done this.
At the same time, there's been a rise in cancers among the people around Point Hope, and they were very afraid that these were all related.
Yeah. It's almost impossible to know if there is a statistically significant rise because the population is so small. But I think it is known that this radiation that was buried there can't have caused cancers among the people. It's 30 miles from the nearest dwelling, and it was under 4 feet of dirt, and it was a very small amount.
Mm-hmm.
So I never thought it had any medical worry associated with it, and I kept the documents for years, planning to treat them in the book. But then I started to think about the legal issue, and I thought, it's possible that somebody will file a native allotment on the Chariot site and unwittingly own a radioactive waste site, which could have made them liable to clean it up. And so at that point, I gave the documents to some of the Point Hopers, and they went to the newspapers with them and the radio stations, and they started calling me. And I said, well, I don't think it's a story. It's not a medical hazard. And I talked John McWhorter out of doing a story on it 2 weeks before it broke in the Daily News, and he'll never forgive me, I'm sure. But I really did think it was overblown, uh-huh. And it's really unfortunate.
It does show how frightened we are. I mean, if it's somewhere else, we think about it and we say we're sorry for those people. But when it's 30 miles from our house, and I don't think it would be any different if it was your or my house, then the houses near, or the Point Hope residence.
Well, you know. Susan, there's kind of a good study to answer that question, and that is that actually more radiation was buried at the Muskox farm right here near where we are over the years by the University of Alaska. Now, this was low-level stuff, not particularly worrisome radionuclides, but it was actually more radiation in Curies than at Point Hope. And that fact never made it into the newspaper, not so much as one column inch on that story in particular.
Why?
I think it is because even though this is in the middle of a residential area on the edge of a community of 80,000 people, that the journalists didn't see the classic setup of supposedly Stone Age man confronting nuclear nightmare. And that's the way I think it was run in the press, and it didn't do anybody any good.
Dan, there's so much more to say in this story. Boy, it's really rich. I want to thank you for spending your time. The book is The Firecracker Boys. The author is Dan O'Neill, the publisher, St. Martin's Press.
You've been listening to a rebroadcast of Susan McGuinness's program, Conversations, from the late 1990s. This summer, we're bringing back select episodes while Northern Soundings is on hiatus. I'm Robert Hannon. Thanks for listening.